Good afternoon, it's members of the come to order. We've got a full schedule today. Representative Pierce?
I don't believe you've, thank you, Ms. Murphy. I don't believe you've visited this committee before, have you?
Mr. Chair, I have not. This is actually my first bill hearing of the whole year, so please keep gentle.
Oh, somebody call House Photography.
he was here before.
Welcome, Representative Sotis. The chair moves that House File 925 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Please proceed with your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Members, I have before you a short bill in length, but I think a very important one. Members, in your packet, you have the bill before you, and you also have an article from the Wall Street Journal. This has to deal with our unemployment rate. Members, having served on committees dealing with labor and commerce in the past, I've always thought it appropriate to address the issue of our unemployment rate. There are multiple perspectives to actually look at our labor market and those persons that are without work, available to work, working part-time jobs, and or collecting unemployment benefits. And right now, we use the U3 method of looking at our unemployment figure. And if you look at the Wall Street Journal article, it tells you that if you take a more broad look and use one of the other measures of unemployment, the U6 factor, I think you would get a broad and a better definition of how many folks are actually unemployed. And I think passing a bill that expands our measurement on unemployment issues and underemployment issues would be helpful for us in two ways. Number one, it would fully explain to Minnesotans and our labor market who and how many are unemployed in the state of Minnesota, and more specifically the state government. We'd get a better handle, I think, on addressing why Minnesotans are unemployed, and directly to our state programs and workforce development or training, we'd have a better sense of who's unemployed and how we can best assist them. So this would simply add to a statute area, and right now under Minnesota state statute, deed needs to provide current state and sub-state labor market information and forecasts in cooperation with other agencies. That is all that deed is asked to do, and they put out this U3 number. And this would just expand that to make sure that the U6 number is utilized as well, so that we have a better understanding of what unemployment is in the state of Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd open for questions.
Representative Sotis, would this bill, would this new definition bring in self-employed people who are not finding work in whatever their area of business is?
Mr. Chair, I also have before to answer questions. From Deed, I have Steve Hines here, too, to answer questions.
I think that I might have just gotten a square on the bingo card.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hines, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and take and proceed.
Thank you, Representative Daphne. My name is Steve Hines. I'm Research Director in the Labor Market Information Office at Deed. We're the office responsible for the production of the current set of employment and unemployment statistics. In answer to your question, the unemployment statistics in general are based on what's called the Current Population Survey, or informally called the Household Survey, which, being a survey of individuals, does include the self-employed.
Okay. So that was a yes?
That's a yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for either the author or Mr. Hines? Seeing none, with that, the chair renews his motion that House File 925 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Pleasure
Chair.
To see you.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The chair would like to move House File 818 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Hillstrom, I know that there are only limited dimensions of your bill that are actually germane to the jurisdiction of this committee. We're trying to get an accurate sections 1, 2, and 5, I'm clear on. 6, Mr. Pender and Ms. Murphy are doing remarkable work right now in real time.
Mr. Chair, if I might, while you work on that, I can just kind of start. And
certainly. If I might just say, we would ask that members' questions and audience comments or concerns be limited to the areas of the bill that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. With that, Representative Hilstrom, please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 818 was brought to me by the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project. And I just wanted to let you know who's been working on this. And this is a consensus proposal. More than 52 agencies, entities, and organizations have been involved in developing this proposal. 50 to 60 individuals participated at each of the 7 stakeholder meeting groups. 10 subcommittees divided the work on specific issues from reporting, definitions, protections, to bring recommendations to the stakeholder groups meeting, and 323 individuals across Minnesota participated in a 39-question online survey to gain broad input onto the issues and gaps in the Vulnerable Adults Act. And so, Mr. Chair, I am proud to be putting forward this bill, but I didn't do it, and so I'd like you to listen to those who did.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Deb Foltz. I am the state long-term care ombudsman. And actually, I am here today to read the testimony from Sandra Anderson, who is a member of the Board on Aging. And she was very, very excited. I'm watching the door because maybe she'll still make it. She was very excited. When I talked to her last night, she said, I'm great at testimony. In fact, I was a communications and drama major in college. So I will try and give it that excitement that she would bring to it. Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Sandra Anderson. I'm a retired senior vice president of Wells Fargo and was the founder and director of Wells Fargo Elder Services, an ASA award-winning program for innovative business practices serving elders and their families. I'm just completing my second term on the Minnesota Board on Aging and was vice chair of the board for 4 years. I'm here today through the Board on Aging and do not in any way speak for Wells Fargo, although I certainly had wide exposure to all of these issues. It's my understanding that this hearing is concerned with the financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. I have 5 quick points about this bill. Number one, this bill amends the current definition of financial exploitation to provide a clear definition that will improve the ability to identify, investigate, and prosecute criminal cases. It will give clarity to language that is currently outmoded and vague and often so confusing no one can prosecute. Number two, banking and financial institutions will be encouraged to report suspected financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. Encouraged, not mandated. Banks are currently restricted by so many sets of rules, who can talk to whom, who can have access to information, and how privacy works, that they end up being more part of the problem than part of the solution. Number three, Section 5 establishes that county attorneys will have subpoena authorities for the banking and financial records of a vulnerable adult. Number four, the bill extends the statute of limitations from 3 to 5 years for criminal financial exploitation cases. From my perspective, it would be beneficial to be involved before all of a vulnerable adult's money and assets are completely extracted. Most often, crimes of financial exploitation do not come to light until the person is destitute or dead. This will align the statute with the limitation periods for crimes of theft by swindle, theft by false representation, and corporate theft. Finally, Section 16 creates a private right of action against a perpetrator for vulnerable adult victims of financial exploitation to recover damages and reasonable administrative costs. So how prevalent is this and why do I care? Why should you care? And here she wants to tell her short story. Shortly after founding Elder Services came the Northwest Wells Fargo merger, and I was given the opportunity to talk about my group, or Plea for Our Lives, if you will, in San Francisco. I made the statement that I thought at least 50% of our clients had been financially abused. I had no facts to back that up. My new boss, a California guy, 20 years my junior, but nice, gave me the first of many eye rolls. I told him I'd checked the facts and moved on. When I got home, I called my staff together, at that time 3 officers and 2 assistants, and asked them to bring customer lists and make a tick mark by everyone that they knew had been financially abused. That number was 76%. As a citizen of the state, I am disgusted that our laws allow that. What is the acceptable number? 50%, 30%, 36%? As public policy or the lack thereof, this is abhorrent. As individuals who are elected representatives of elders, the daughters, sons, nieces, nephews, and friends of elders who may be elders or, God willing, will be elders, look into your own hearts and follow your values. That's why you're elected. Thank you for your time today. Please call the Board on Aging for any time for additional information. Part of their charge is to be advisory to you and to use them. They know amazing stuff. With that, I would just like to also add that my office, being an ombudsman office, we receive thousands of calls every year, and over half of those calls are financial exploitation. And that is the area that is actually increasing the fastest in the areas of abuse, concerns, complaints that we see from our perspective. So I stand ready to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Hill, from anyone else who you're bringing to testify today?
Mr. Chair, I'm not, but I have a lot of people to answer questions if you would care to have.
Phone a friend as needed. Any questions for Representative Hillstrom or the testifier from members of the committee? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 818? Representative Hillstrom, parting words?
Please vote yes.
All right. I do want to thank you and the folks from the elder law community for bringing this forward. The work I've done in the past on consumer privacy and the like has led me into some of these areas of financial exploitation of elders, and it's an uncomfortable conversation because often they are being victimized by their own children or other relatives.
You are absolutely correct, Mr. Chairman. I didn't mention that in her testimony, but that is almost always the case. It's a family member, and so they're very difficult. And I just want to reemphasize what Representative Hillstrom said. This has been an enormous consensus effort by everyone in the state, bipartisan, and all the different agencies, including providers and advocates and citizens. So thank you for your time.
Credit to all involved. With that, Chair renews his motion that House File 818 be recommended to pass, and we referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, if you would take the chair. Representative Nelson, as I've seen you preview the minutes, I'm so glad that you moved the minutes. Are there any corrections or deletions to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? They're passed. Representative Dabney, you've gotten smaller. Why don't you come up? President Dabney, which bill did you wish to do first? You have two of them on the calendar today.
I recognize that. I would like to do House File 1116 first, if we could. And there's a representative from Deed here. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1116 to be before the committee, recommended to pass, and we referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please proceed with your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, the House File 1116 is a policy and housekeeping bill brought forward by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Many of the changes are technical, are updates of statutes, cleaning up the statutes in a number of areas. There are a few small policy issues included in Article 1 from various units of deed and Article 3 on unemployment insurance, which are the two areas of this bill that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. With me today is someone who can speak more knowledgeably of these than I can. So, Mr. Chair, I would like to hand it over to her at this time.
Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Catherine Sherman Hohen, and I am with the legislative team of the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Please proceed.
Okay. This bill is in four articles. Article 1 and Article 2 are the deed, policy, and housekeeping. Article 3 and Article 4 are unemployment insurance, and Craig Gustafson is here with unemployment insurance to explain those. The piece of Article 1 that falls under this committee's jurisdiction is a change to our blind vendor statute. This is a change regarding our workers' compensation policy. The change should be found on Section 6 of Article 1. This change adds language that clarifies that the department is not liable under Chapter 176, which is workers' compensation, for a blind vendor's employee's injury. The reason that we made this change is that for the rehabilitation of blind persons, the commissioner has exclusive authority to establish and operate... Sorry, I've got the wrong piece there. The reason we made this change is that we traditionally have not been considered liable for any workers' compensation lawsuit that would come against one of our blind vendors. The blind vendors are required by rule and contract to operate their businesses in accordance with federal, state, and local laws, and they hold the state harmless if they fail to do so. But recently we did have a blind vendor who did not have workers' compensation insurance, and one of his former employees filed for benefits. The blind vendor's attorney is trying to cast a larger net to protect his client, the state, and they have come and sued the state now. Currently we're working with the Attorney General's office to handle this case. It looks probable that under the workers' compensation statute we may actually have to pay out. The Attorney General's office did suggest that we make this change. It's a fairly minor change. It's never been the intent of the state to, when we were establishing and operating the program, to be liable for workers' compensation, and so we would like to enact a clarifying law. We do not feel that changing the statute now would affect the case that's already pending. There is no retroactive language. And it's the opinion of the Attorney General and our attorney for this case that it would have no effect on the lawsuit that's currently happening. Are there any questions? Otherwise, Craig? Thank you.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Gustafson. I'm the Director of Appeals Operations and Legal Affairs for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm here to answer any questions on the unemployment insurance policy and technical articles of the bill, Articles 3 and 4. Two provisions that I point out in Article 3 are Section 8 regarding suitable employment. Currently, the law provides that to be considered available for suitable employment and thus eligible to receive unemployment benefits, a student must be willing to quit school to accept suitable employment. We're modifying that slightly to recognize the fact that a lot of people are taking online courses and have flexible schedules with their schooling, so the new change would allow for that. And we changed the language of quit to discontinue for those cases where someone simply wants to delay their schooling rather than quit it altogether. So I think that's one of the more prominent provisions. And then Section 9 is a provision that would expand exceptions to ineligibility for quitting employment to care for an ill, injured, or disabled immediate family member. Currently, the law only provides you're able to quit to care for yourself, basically, for your own medical condition. And so this would expand eligibility for those who need to quit their jobs to care for a family member, and family member is also defined in that section. So I'm open for any questions on unemployment insurance as well.
Are there any questions from the committee members? You've got a lot of... This is like, I think, the third time I've seen a couple features of this particular bill. Boy, the department has got it in every place possible. My question to you, are you timing the passage of these bills so that the last one takes precedent, is the one you really want?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, the idea is that some of these provisions are very important to the department, and hopefully we will coordinate our efforts so that the language doesn't conflict in any of these various vehicles that the language is currently traveling in.
Thank you.
Yep.
See, no questions. That sounds, looks like we're ready to vote. Any parting comments, Mr. Chair?
Please vote yes.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Mr. Chair. On to the next one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the members, the staff from Deeds, for their assistance today.
Representative Dabney, you have another bill up on the calendar, 1214.
I do. excuse me, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 1214 be before the committee, recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Mr. Chair, House File 1214 deals with contracts for deed and rent-to-own situations in our communities. It's another one of the bills that I'm carrying that focus on the impact of the declining economy on our constituents and the ability of this legislature to look forward and anticipate and prevent problems for our constituents rather than closing the barn door after the proverbial horse or cow has gotten away. Contracts for deed have been used for many years. They have, however, been on the decline. It's only in the most recent time period with the credit crunch and the collapse of subprime mortgage lending that we're seeing a resurgence in contract for deed transactions. There's growing anecdotal concerns I'm hearing from cities and others about possible abuses in these contract for deed scenarios and a desire to make sure that everyone in the transaction is clear on what the process is, what their rights are, and what their responsibilities are in a contract for deed transaction or a rent-to-own transaction. The core of this bill, then, is simply notice to the participating party. With me today, Mr. Chair, is Mr. Ron Elwood from Legal Services Advocacy Project. Before he speaks, I would like to offer a one small oral amendment on page 8 of the bill, line 23. After the word retains, please delete the word see. Let me repeat that. Page 8, line 23. After retains, delete the word see.
Any objections to the oral amendment? You want to move the amendment?
Oh, let me move that amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any objections to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Your bill is in the fashion that you would like.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
You're on. Would you like to explain the bill and the sections that we are supposed to deal with in this particular committee? In great detail, I'm sure you have all of that, in case someone has a detailed question for you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, I'd be delighted to go through the bill, and hopefully I can answer all those detailed questions with detailed answers. I'll just run through the sections quickly. Section 1 really is a cleanup from last year in our when we did all the foreclosure legislation, and particularly here with respect to the tenant protections that we installed last year. This section that was amended last year was intended to make sure that all tenants, regardless of when they leased up, whether before or after the foreclosure sale, were provided with the statutory notice to vacate, so they knew that they had to get out by X date. It was to correct the court decision that had indicated that people who leased after the foreclosure sale were not entitled to the notice. In the revisions of the language, there apparently has been some concerns registered that there was an ambiguity place in the statute that while we granted the rights to the tenants at least after the sale, we may have had some privilege to question whether the people who leased before the sheriff's sale are entitled to the notice. So what this does is remove any ambiguity that all tenants, no matter when they lease up, are entitled to the notice, and this was a unanimous, non-controversial issue that everybody agreed to, so it's a cleanup. Section 2 then starts the guts of the bill, and it is a provision that would simply make it clearer about when the contract for deed is recorded that the vendor assures that the contract is in a recordable form and that if there are taxes that need to be paid in order for that deed to be recorded, that it is the obligation of the vendor to pay. Section 3 is really the crux. Sections 3 and 4 are really the crux of this bill. And as Representative Dabney said, they do contain the disclosures. And that's what, if you move on to subdivision 3 there on page 3, line 16, is where the disclosure is required. The actual disclosures that have to be provided would be beginning in subdivision 4 on line, starting on line 3.25. And essentially what they do is explain what the basics of a transaction of this nature are. And in your packets is an article from the Star Tribune in November, which I think illustrates very clearly why this bill is needed, because the article talks about a person trying to get into a rent-to-own situation, but the reporter conflated that with contract for deed. So, in fact, there was a correction several weeks later. So I think that this illustrates the confusion around these kinds of transactions. Contracts for deeds are complicated and unusual legal transactions. As you probably know, once the contract is signed, the ownership of the property is in some odd place. It's in a strange limbo situation because the person who has sold the property holds the title but no longer owns it. The person who signs the contract, the buyer, that buyer does not own that property at that point either. So it's an unusual transaction. It is a good one. It's needed. Today many of the nonprofits are using this to get people into home ownership that otherwise would be precluded because of their inability to get financing. And also we have a situation where the sellers are having difficulty selling their homes. This is a trusted vehicle in Minnesota. What this bill does is very simple. It gives people some basic information about what the transaction is, and then as you move on to page 4 and 5 of the bill, it suggests things that they should consider before signing, particularly go see a lawyer, go see the home ownership center, get some information, explains what their responsibilities are as buyers. So for example, people ought to know that it's their responsibility to pay the taxes and the insurance. People ought to know before they sign on the dotted line that if there's a fire and there's a loss and they don't have insurance, they lose their house but they still owe all the contract amount. So people need to know that. On page 5, for example, the disclosure explains what happens if they miss a payment and the fact that they could lose all the money they've paid and be out of that house in 60 days. This is and that they don't have any protections of the mortgage the foreclosure laws that we have in Minnesota. They don't apply to this kind of transaction. Page 6 on subdivision 6 provides the right to cancel regarding this kind of a transaction. It's a little convoluted, so if I can just explain exactly what it says in plain English, it might be easier. The bottom line here is if the disclosures are provided more than 10 days before the signing of the purchase agreement, there is no right to cancel. So people have the opportunity to look at the disclosures, make a decision, go through with it. They've already had plenty of time. But if the disclosures are provided less than 10 days before the signing, then there is a 10-day window to cancel the transaction. However, there is a provision within this section or subdivision that allows for a waiver, and then the window reduces down to 3 days. So it could be as little as 3 days as somebody has to take a look at this to say, what am I getting myself into? Should I go see do something? Should I get an appraisal? Should I do some of these things? Just have a chance to think for a few minutes before they sign on a dotted line. And that's what we think is very important. This is the controversial piece of the bill, however, and you will hear from the opponents who don't believe that this is an appropriate provision. But I'll let them speak for themselves. And finally, with the contract for deed on page 7, there is a provision that says that if the disclosures are not provided at all, then there is an offset of $500 for a future contract payment. So essentially, if you didn't get the disclosures, you get a $500. There's a penalty which goes against a future contract. So that's the contract for deed disclosure section. Moving on to page 7, we go to the lease with the option to purchase agreements, commonly known as rent-to-own. Unfortunately, that's a misnomer, because I think rent-to-own implies for people, or people believe that it's like, you know, you go down, you get the furniture or the TV, and when you make your final payment, you own the property. Well, that's not the case here. Really, all you're doing is spending $1,500, $2,000, $2,500, whatever it is, for an option to buy this property at a future date. And so, similar to the provisions that we had previously on the contracts for deeds, these are disclosures of a very similar nature that are specific to the lease with the option to purchase. Same kind of thing, the basics, what they are, what your rights are, what the rights of the landlord is, are, and the like. And that's essentially the bill. I'd be happy to answer some questions.
You mentioned opponents to the bill. I suspect they want to come down. I do have, myself have a couple of questions. I don't want to get too deeply into civil law, because this is a labor and consumers committee. How are you delivering, and how are you recording or documenting the delivery of all these documents? And how big are they? Because most of the mortgage and financial readings that I had, in my age, I need to get my magnifying glass out to read them. So, and then unless there's other questions, I'll call down any opponents that you might have.
Mr. Chair, to answer your questions, let me take the second one first. I actually put these disclosures on an 8.5 by 11 sheet just to see how long they are, and they're basically about 4 pages, but 2 pages double-sided. So they're not very long, and I think if you really look through them, you'll see that they're written in very, very plain English that people could understand. And I think that's part of the problem with, even if these disclosures are in the contract document, I think they're written in a way that most people probably wouldn't understand them if you didn't have a lawyer with you. So that's answering your first question. And second question. Your first question, I believe, that the disclosures have to be provided and signed and dated, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm going to try to find where that is.
There is a rebuttable presumption of signed and dated.
Ah, right. Thank you. On page 3, line 21, if there's an issue of whether or not the disclosures were provided, then we do put in the statute there's
right before the rebuttable presumption.
There's something in there that says that if it's not provided by the seller, if the seller can't produce a copy, then essentially the idea was that it wasn't given.
That might have to have a little extra work by the time you get to civil law or Mr. Mullery's committee. Leaves a real wide angle for a lawyer to take a shot at you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Any persons that are would like to testify for or against this particular bill? Going once. Oh, now they're getting up.
Oh. Before they go down, Mr. Chair. Sure. Can I just say one last comment?
Actually, no. You have time. You can come back.
Okay.
Now come on down. Line them up. Boy, you get... You know, I didn't have any opponents to my bills this morning.
You know, it's like...
It's the nicer guy I got.
That's certainly true. I think it's like being in the media. You know, as long as they... get your name right, the attention is good, so.
Well, they're lining up, so who wants to go first? Christine, come on down. Why don't you identify yourself to the tape and tell us what how much you love or dislike this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Christine Berger, and I represent the 20,000 members of the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today. We respectfully oppose House File 1214. This is an important issue for us. It's not that we... are against disclosure. It's just the methodology used in the bill that we have a problem with. And we have been dialoguing with the proponents since December, since we first heard that this might be a bill. There was a time where Mr. Elwood and myself were talking, I think, almost daily. And we have proposed a solution, which is on the back of a handout that was circled around to the committee. So, and I have gotten the authority from the lobbyists from the Builders Association of Minnesota that they agree with us as well on this issue. Thank you. And I will turn the comments over to Mr. Chris Renz, who is part of our legal counsel.
Well, thank you. Please identify yourself for the tape and go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Chris Renz. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Realtors. As was said, the Minnesota Association of Realtors respectfully opposes the passage of House File 1214. Disclosure as a goal of this bill is laudable, and in fact, the Minnesota Association of Realtors has a history of being in favor of disclosure, the prime example being the residential real property disclosure requirements that are already lost. The problem is the process in this bill, namely the cooling off rescission period, which Mr. Elwood described and is quite complicated. As the committee is aware, and as Representative Mahoney's comments that we've indicated, we're in the middle of a national economic slowdown. One of the primary pillars of that is a stagnant real estate market where properties are not moving. We should, as the legislature, be encouraging commerce and not slowing it down. Contract for deed is a particularly relevant tool in these times, and as was indicated, there's been a resurgence in them. And the reason for that is that there are many sellers who are unable to sell their houses with a traditional financing route where the buyers come to purchase the house by a financing route. We also have people with unestablished credit, such as first-time home buyers or poor credit. We're also in the middle of a credit squeeze where banks currently don't have money that they are willing to give out. Contract for deed bridges that gap. It allows properties to be moved without having to go those traditional routes, and it is a tool to recommence the commerce in the real estate market, and it should not be bogged down with the requirements that are in 1214. Procedural complication. I believe that Mr. Elwood described it as convoluted, so I would suggest procedural complication causes delay, inhibition, and chilling. This is the first reason that the Minnesota Association of Realtors believes that the bill should not pass. It retards commerce. The second is that there is no evident need for the legislation. I see a couple of newspaper articles, but despite repeated requests from the Minnesota Association of Realtors, we've seen no evidence, certainly no statistics, that a problem actually exists. All that we have is anecdotal evidence, and I would suggest respectfully that I'm not sure that the legislature should be creating legislation on simply that, particularly where, as I said, this legislation creates complication and inefficiency. Not only is there not a need for this legislation, but there is no reason for a distinction between contracts for deeds and other significant transactions that people enter into, which don't have any such complicated procedural requirement of a cooling off period. Examples include the mortgage or cash purchase of a home, entering into a promissory note, entering into a lease, purchasing a car. Like other transactions, like these transactions, which are far more complex, I believe Representative Mahoney, I understood your question to be how long is a typical contract for deed? The uniform conveyancing blank is 6 pages long. It's not like a mortgage or a promissory note, which is multiple pages. It's a fairly concise document, and it is not more...
Do you happen to have one with you?
I do, Your Honor.
Don't call me an honor.
Sorry.
Last time I tried to get that word honor in my title, they started throwing things at me.
I apologize.
It was my own union.
Typical setting for me.
Why don't you pass that around so the members can see it?
The length and complexity of this uniform conveyancing blank pales in comparison to the other transactions for which there is no cooling off period. You can go and get a mortgage today, no cooling off period. You can enter into a lease, regardless of the payment, today, no cooling off period. Go purchase a car today. The cooling off period is not for those transactions. I don't know why it would be here. To the extent that there is transactional duress, that is, somebody is feeling pressured to enter into a transaction. And I believe what was mentioned by the prior supporters of the bill was a chance to think. There are very limited instances where a person doesn't have a chance to think. Those would be, for example, in foreclosure reconveyances, but this legislature has already addressed those in Chapter 325N. But for those very limited circumstances, you have all the time in the world before a contract for deed to decide whether to enter into it. It is an infinite and indefinite cooling off period before entering into such transaction as would be with any other transaction. There's no reason for this distinction, and there's no reason to have this just for contract for deed, which is what this legislation seeks to do. In addition, committee members, the purported concern that I understand to be the basis for this bill is that there are predatory contract for deed vendors. Again, there has been no evidence that we've seen that they're actually, outside of some anecdotes, that this is actually occurring. But regardless, the proposed legislation does not effectively address this. The Subdivision 6, which is the subdivision which has the portions with consequences if you fail to follow the procedures in the beginning, really has to do with if you enter into a purchase agreement for a contract for deed. In other words, an agreement where I'm going to enter into a contract for deed, then there are all sorts of repercussions and ways that the timeline changes, and some of those were described. But I would submit that in most of these predatory situations, following complicated procedures like a purchase agreement for contract for deed before a contract for deed is unlikely. They will likely just enter in for a contract for deed. And the way this is written, the only penalty for that and not providing a disclosure in that instance is a $500 fine. I think it's described as something else. It's an offset, but that's all it is. This is not going to curb, this is unlikely to curb the predatory contract for deed vendors, which is supposedly at the basis of the statute. For these reasons and the reasons that are in the memorandum that's been passed around, the Minnesota Association of Realtors opposes House File 1214 in its current form. I would also suggest that it is not a foreclosure-related bill. I understand that that's some of what's been indicated as its impetus, but there's nothing really foreclosure-specific within the bill. The Minnesota Association of Realtors, as was suggested, has provided a compromise, and it's on the memorandum that's submitted to the committee members. The beauty of the compromise is that it accomplishes the goal of disclosure because it makes sure that everyone knows what's going on without the roadblock to commerce. It is the belief and understanding of the Minnesota Association of Realtors that the primary form that's used is the one that was passed around. That's the Minnesota Uniform Conveyancing Blank. It's available from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. The suggestion by the Minnesota Association of Realtors is that the disclosures would be provided on the Uniform Conveyancing Blank. By providing the disclosure in the form, it's the disclosure best effectuated because it's in the hands of the people actually using it. It's information to those who might not read the statute, which I would submit may likely be contract for deed buyers. providing it just in the statute, and instead we're trying to provide it in the form. If you provide it in the statute, there's no guarantee it will be understood, read, or followed. In fact, this legislature passed a prior provision requiring contract for deeds to be recorded, and my understanding is that that is hardly taking place. But just providing in a statute doesn't necessarily make it so. The proposal by
excuse me, just a minute. I don't like to cut you off, but we've got a couple other bills today, so
I'm very, very close.
Oh, good. Yes, thank you.
The proposal from the Minnesota Association of Realtors discloses the risks and the unique traits of contracts for deeds in a precise and clear manner. It's in a format, the Uniform Conveyancing Blank, where it actually will have effect. And for those reasons, the Minnesota Association of Realtors opposes the bill as it's currently House File 1214, and if implementing any legislation in this regard, it should be the compromise proposal, which is better suited to effectuate the disclosure purpose while not complicating and delaying commerce. Thank you.
Just so you know, we uphold and prevent reforms on anecdotal evidence around here, so anything on anecdotal might, don't want to go down that road. Are there any questions for this particular witness? Representative Murdoch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at that uniform code over there, is that in use throughout the state on a contract for deed sale?
Go
right ahead.
Sure. Yes, it is in use. It's on the State Department of Minnesota Department of Commerce website. It is not the required form. There are other forms that can be used, but it's widely used throughout the state as deed conveyancing blank.
Go right ahead.
In looking at that form, and I've bought and sold property and contracts for deeds over the years, and looking at the language in here, what happens to your last payment, what if you miss a payment, it's all in there. It looks to me like we don't need to deal with this bill, because or this section of the bill. Everything's in there except the 10-day part to get out of the contract, which I don't agree with the 10-day part of it. But it looks to me like everything that's in here is in there.
I couldn't agree more. In hoping to come to a compromise with the supporters of the bill, we had talked about making it, changing it so that it was a little more pointed and out in the open, because disclosure is important. But you're right, it's in there in different language.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up.
Quickly, though.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Christine Berger with the Realtors again. Again, just to reiterate, just a concise piece on the front of the uniform conveyancing blank stating, this is not a mortgage. If you default, you get 60 days. Very basic, concise, on the front, so people see it right away is what we're proposing. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just for your information in the committee, before you go to Mr. Dunleavy, I do have another testifier who could come up after Mr. Dunleavy is fine. Yes, go ahead.
My name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. And I apologize to Representative Dabney that I haven't spoken with him directly about this. I was pleased to meet Representative Dabney in the foreclosure study groups that occurred before the last session of the legislature, and during that time I spent about 260 pro bono hours helping draft legislation, including disclosure legislation, and a large portion of the foreclosure remediation legislation that was passed in the last session was drafted by me. And one of the things that taught me, and some of the other lessons I've learned over the years from drafting real estate legislation, is that there's a lot of unintended consequences. And I can give you an anecdote about one of those that occurred in the last session, where I had to, the statute was passed at the request of the city of Minneapolis to make 5-week redemptions easier to get, because they didn't want properties being abandoned and demolished. And so I drafted something that said if the debtor didn't appear at the hearing, that was conclusive evidence of abandonment. Well, I had a young couple come to me, and they said that they had bought this house, and a speculator had purchased an assessment lien and done a 5-week redemption period on that, and they were going to lose their house for about a $1,500 lien. That was something nobody could have anticipated. This legislation, unfortunately, I can see a lot of potential adverse consequences from this legislation. The primary one and the main reason that the Bar Association, or at least the real property section, is opposed to this legislation is that it might make contracts for deed less usable in the future for real estate transactions. And that's at a time when conventional financing is not available for many people except those with sterling credit. That means a lot of people aren't going to be able to buy houses. I also like to mention that I got to know Ron Elwood really well last session. I think we've worked together before, but I like to call Ron a friend of mine, and you probably all don't know that he plays in a band, and I've gotten the pleasure of listening to him and dancing to him at a fundraiser for Legal Aid. Ron and I have talked a lot about this legislation. I think he has a pretty good idea of, you know, what my objections are. As far as the, we've talked about the uniform conveyancing blank. I've got a copy of it too. This form was promulgated over a long period of time by the Bar Association with the approval of the Commerce Department. This, as far as I know, I've never seen any other form used in Minnesota besides the contractor deed form. And I agree that this form has all of the disclosures that are in this legislation with one exception, and that is that it doesn't specifically say that a cancellation can occur in 60 days. Okay. Everything else that's in there is, everything else that's discussed in these cancellations in the statute is, or in this bill, is in here. So my suggestion, and I believe that the real property section of the bar,
I'm going to ask you to kind of close up your remarks here because we've got a fairly contentious bill after this and we're getting closer to the time where we're going to need to be done. So if I could move this along.
Okay. The situation that normally occurs with a contractor deed is two relatively unsophisticated consumers. And I like to say Ma and Pa Kettle are selling their house to a young couple. That's frequently the situation. This isn't a situation where you've got a predatory lender versus an unsophisticated consumer. So the balancing of the risk, I think, is kind of uneven because of this. The seller has probably a greater risk when they sell the property because the buyer might not pay, they might have to cancel it, the property might be subject to waste, they have to resell it, they end up spending a lot of money. The buyer, on the other hand, doesn't have a lot of risk. Their risk is that their down payment, their monthly payment. That's about it, a loss of equity. So the seller really has a greater risk than the buyer does.
Well, frankly, I'm going to ask for this particular testifier here. I'm going to warn him to be very, very short because I will cut you off too because we have, like they say, we have that contested bill. So Mr. Elroy, unless you have something new to imply, you do not need to come back up here. Go for it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dan Tyson, the firm of Best and Flanagan. I'm a member of the Bar Association Real Property Section as well as Mr. Dunleavy. I know Kevin Dunleavy. I've not danced with him, but I have danced around. I've danced around.
You danced with that guy too, and
I know.
That's why he's not testifying anymore.
I've had the privilege of speaking before to this body on a matter relating to the equity stripping bill in past years. I've been involved with the equity stripping task force, which is, I won't go into the details now, but we've taken on predatory practices in the real estate industry relating to equity stripping. I'm here today to say that we need to have this bill to protect the next generation of potential fraud. The contract for deed will be used, whether we have a form that has a disclosure in there or not, unfortunately, by people who want to take advantage of others. The disclosure that is provided and the time period that's provided will allow a cool-off period, which I think is essential, much like the Condominium Act, which came in 1984 or before and provided a cool-off period for people getting into a very complex transaction, i.e. the purchase of a condominium. The same thing is true with contracts for deed. Contracts for deed are not simple. It's a combined note, a combined mortgage, a combined financing, and most people really don't understand the contract for deed. Most lawyers who haven't drafted them in 20 years don't understand the contract for deed. So we need to have this legislation to put in front of people the opportunity to seek out competent advice and then go forward. The realtors are suggesting that, oh, we can put it into the contract for deed. That's too late. the purchase agreement, which is the document that they are so well-versed at, as our lawyers, in guiding a transaction from offer to acceptance to closing, needs to happen first. And if people are going to use contract for deed language, and that is a financing tool to make things happen today, then that needs to be in the purchase agreement and not, and it has to occur prior to signing the contract for deed.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witnesses? Are there any questions for the witnesses? Representative Downey, do you have any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the clear question before the committee is, where do people get the notice that we all agree to? Early in the process or later? And do we act now to prevent future problems? I ask for your support.
Thank you. Representative Dabney, he moves his motion for House File 1214 and recommended pass and refer to Committee on Commerce as amended and referred to Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, you're still here. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Lesh, House File 612, which I think Representative Mahoney characterized as contentious. Mm-hmm. Contentious, I believe, is his word. Representative Nelson, would you like to move House File 612?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 612 to be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Lead me to it. Thank you. Representative Lesh,
thank you.
Welcome.
Dabney, I would characterize this as a peace in the valley bill.
All right.
I brought this at the behest of Representative Murdoch, who was chagrined to discover that we didn't have sick days as legislators when we got elected. I'm kidding. I didn't really. In fact, why don't, in the interest of time, why don't I bring my testifiers up here? Representative Dabney, I have Delania Paris, Barb Johnson, Patty Tanji, and Denise Welty, if they can come up, because I'm going to be very brief here. If I could, Mr. Chair and members, what this bill does is establish minimum standards for sick days in the state of Minnesota. The United States is the only country of major westernized or industrialized democracies that does not have mandatory paid sick days. It would establish them in Minnesota. It establishes sick days as 1 hour for every 30 hours worked. For small employers, which are 10 or fewer employees, you can get as many as 40 hours in a year, which you can also carry over, but that's a cap. For large employers, above that 11 or more employees, you can accrue or carry over up to 72 hours in a year. You can use these for your child, members of your own family. That is established in section. Well, why don't I just go over the individual aspects of it, Mr. Chair. Sick days begin accruing on the first day of employment but cannot be used as accrued until after 90 days of employment. It can be used to care for an employee's own illness or physical or mental condition, to obtain a medical diagnosis or related treatment, or to obtain preventive care. Also to care for a family member for any of the above reasons or due to an absence caused by domestic violence. And as a prosecutor who has prosecuted domestic violence, Mr. Chair and members, this occurs from time to time where individuals have problems because of this, especially my victim witnesses who consistently run into problems for this. It allows that employers may take reasonable measures to verify or document that an employee's use of paid sick days is lawful. It provides for effective enforcement, including sufficient worker notification, protection from retaliation, and remedies for non-compliance. The coalition that came together to support this, members, includes Minnesota ACORN, the Minnesota AFL-CIO,
Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, Minnesota Women's Political Caucus, AFSCME Council 5, Business and Professional Women of Minnesota, Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota, SEIU, St. Paul Regional Labor Federation, USCW, and Unite HERE. Finally, before I go on to my testifiers, Mr. Chair and members, I'd just like to state that there have been some wild accusations tossed about as to what this bill actually does or what would occur if this happened. And I'm noting, for example, from a letter submitted in opposition by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, noting that 74% of employers already offer paid sick leave policies. The statistics that we show from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Mr. Chair and members, is that 41% of workers in Minnesota do not have them. So as you can see, you can twist the numbers any way you like, but we're here to make legislation for people here, and 41% of Minnesotans do not. And for many of this, I see sitting on this committee, that proportion of your constituents is probably much higher, because the heaviest burden falls upon individuals in the healthcare industry and food service industry, as well as child care workers. And you imagine which are the industries where you think having sick leave options might be most important when you go in and order your burger or take your child to be taken care of or make sure that grandma's doing well in the nursing home. Who do you want to make sure that where the workers are healthiest in those areas? I also note, for example, as an example of some of the potentially misinformation, there's a on the back side of that document passed out by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Norby's Department Store, Detroit Lakes, an individual said he would go bankrupt if this were passed because his total hours were over 40,000 worked in that year. If every 30 hours we'd have to accrue 1 hour of sick pay, that would be devastating. As is clear by this legislation, Mr. Chair and members, it does not do that. It would not accrue at 40,000. And this is the kind of information that's going around about it, so I hope you take that into consideration. With that, I would ask our first testifier, and I believe it's Delinia.
Representative Lesh, and to the testifiers on both sides, we do have a cast of thousands. I think everyone in the room wants to testify either for or, I'm sorry to say, Ms. Lesh, against the bill. We do have another committee coming in here at 2:45. I would like to have each side try to limit their testimony to 10 minutes. What that requires of testifiers is that you be brief and focused and to the best of your ability. If it's been said once, repetition is a positive thing in other places, but not the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ma'am, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Delinia Paris.
Oh, hi. Please speak into the microphone. You are being recorded.
Sorry.
Quite all right.
After 2 years of working at an apartment complex, it all unraveled. Because of my neglect of myself, I became ill very quickly. I went into kidney failure. As soon as I got sick, my oldest daughter started having mental health issues and was hospitalized, and my youngest daughter was attacked at school. And if that wasn't enough, my son was diagnosed with autism. I had to stay at home because of my own health. My daughter's fears of being attacked at school, I went to meetings for my son's behavior and also attended appointments in Wisconsin where my oldest daughter was hospitalized. Because I worked for the apartment complex, I not only lost my job, I lost my house, my housing, and I was homeless. If I had 7 paid sick days, all of this would have been avoided. Thank you.
Thank you. To the next testifier. Again, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Davini and committee members, thank you for allowing me to participate in this hearing today. My name is Patty Tanzi. I'm the president-elect of Business and Professional Women Minnesota, an organization of over 400 working women who either own their own businesses or are employed in various professions. Our members understand that these are very tough economic times for many business owners. Layoffs and job freezes are the only answer to a healthy bottom line. But we also know that healthy employees can help during economic tough times. A minimum standard for paid sick days is a step in the right direction. With paid sick days, we support our employees by encouraging them to stay away from the workplace when they are ill. With paid sick days, we support our employees by giving them the freedom to stay home with sick kids or parents so they don't bring their anxieties to work. And paid sick days support our employees who feel demoralized for having to choose between a family and a paycheck. Large businesses have been offering paid sick days for decades. They know the bottom line benefits of healthy employees. This bill levels the playing field between small and large businesses who compete for talent from the same workforce pool. We understand that there will be many short-term costs for providing paid sick days, but the longer-term benefits are increased productivity when our workers show up to work healthy, less use of their health care resources as workers are sick for shorter periods of time, and less workers and children contract diseases in the workplace. Less lawsuits arise from foodborne outbreaks, and the estimated business savings totals $11.69 per week per worker for lower turnover, improved productivity, and reduced spread of illness. In San Francisco, a paid sick day law went into effect February 2007. There's been no negative impact on unemployment, and businesses have thrived as a result. Especially, and this is in, despite the fact that we have a national economic slowdown. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Tandry. Please go ahead, introduce yourself to the tape, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Denise Welty. I'm from Rochester, and I'm a former family child care provider of over 28 years. And I know firsthand what it's like to take care of sick children. The sick pay bill is going to be wonderful for our children and to keep kids healthy. More than 94 million working people do not have a single paid sick day to use to care for sick children. Low-income parents are even more likely not to have paid sick days. When parents have no choice but to send sick children to school or daycare, the health of other children, teachers, and child care providers like myself are put at risk. When children are sick, they need to be cared for by a parent or guardian. Younger children in particular need parental care and supervision, and children of all ages need parents to take them to medical appointments and administer medicine. Most child care facilities have policies requiring children to stay at home. The American Academy of Pediatrics has established specific inclusion criteria for sick children. Without access to paid sick time off, this is the primary reason the parents' decision not to stay home with their sick children. Many parents just do not have the option of staying home. Working parents with paid sick time off or paid vacation days are 5 times more likely to stay home with a sick child. With paid sick days, parents are able to take their kids to well-child visits and for immunizations, which may prevent serious illness. Studies show that children recover faster when cared for by their parents. The mere presence of parents shortens a child's hospital stay by 31%, reducing the health care cost. Working parents need a basic workplace standard of paid sick days so they don't have to choose between keeping their job and caring for the children's health. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lesh, you've got one last testifier?
Yes.
Ma'am, please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Hello, my name is Barbara Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for letting me tell my story. This bill would have really helped me when I was working, and I'm here because it will really help others. I grew up as a victim of domestic violence. Then I married an abuser. After many years with help, I was able to leave. I learned about healthy relationships. I lived through the struggles endured by women in abusive relationships and know the barriers to their escape. When I was leaving the abusive relationship, I was working full time. I ultimately had to take time off to go to a shelter, to get an order for protection, return to my apartment with a police escort to get my belongings, and deal with the court systems. I lived paycheck to paycheck, missing even just one day of work would have put me behind on my bills. Often while on my breaks, I had to make phone calls to deal with systems people about the domestic violence. Sometimes I became so upset by crying, I would run to the bathroom. I would have to try to calm myself down so that I could return to work. Sometimes I would be sent home because I wasn't cheerful or happy. I was sad and upset. I lost at least half a dozen jobs because of this. I am not alone in this. Often, women need time to recover from injuries resulting from domestic violence and cannot physically return to work. Now I'm in a stable place in my life and thankfully no longer have to deal with the abuse. I'm here today speaking about this bill because it would have helped me. And I'm also speaking about this bill for all the women who are not able to be here today because they can't afford to take this time off. I really hope that you do support this bill for healthy families and a healthy workplace.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh, and thank you to your concise testifier.
Thank you. And I would ask, if we could, this being a policy committee, there were some questions raised about fiscal implications. Mr. Chair, I would ask if there aren't any. Okay, just making sure that we weren't taking that testimony in the interest of...
That's correct. We try to stay on the jurisdiction of the committee. We do have others who are interested in testifying. Taking it from the top, Keith Carlson, Jamie, I'm going to get your... Keith isn't here. Jamie's... Cool. Thank you. That was much better than what I was going to say. Lori Elliott. On deck, Jeremy Espenson. Buzz Anderson. We can pick up after that. Don't be shy. It doesn't get you anything. No fighting. And again, the proponents were able to keep it down to about 10 minutes. If you could try to do the same, that would facilitate things and be appreciated. Please,
yes,
go ahead.
We will do our very best. My name is Lori Elliott. I'm the Human Resources Manager at the City of Shoreview, Minnesota, and I'm here on behalf of the League as well as the City of Shoreview. I have three concerns about this bill. First of all, starting with the cost and the fiscal whatever. But I took a look at our August 12th payroll from 2008, and I looked at our non-benefited group of employees. We had 8,089 hours worked. I divided that out by an hour for every 30 hours of sick leave. I looked at our average wage for this group, which is about $10 an hour. So that the value of the sick leave for that single payroll period is about $2,700. That's 1 2-week period. We just see that this is way out of our fiscal abilities to pay for. We estimate it would cost over $30,000 a year just for the City of Shoreview. And for the record, we're a population of about 27,000. The second thing that concerns me about this, and that is where we're getting into this high dollar amount, is that this is an all-inclusive bill. We hear a lot of high school and college students. We hear a lot of testimony from people who are married with children or single with children. Majority of our workforce in this non-benefited category are high school and college students who are not married and do not have children. They are teaching fitness classes, so maybe working 3-4 hours a week, or their life starting outside of their school obligations, maybe working 15 hours a week. All of these groups would be included within this bill because the threshold is 56 hours. So roughly, if you work an hour and 15 minutes a week, you're eventually going to clock in on this bill and earn sick leave. And I view it as sort of a no-brainer that if I'm going to take time off to go to the doctor, I might as well schedule when I'm supposed to be at work because I'm going to be paid to be at the doctor. And we've experienced it. I've been in the field long enough that I understand that people do work the system that way. So that is our concern. And the third concern is really the administrative workload that goes with this. While we're a small city, we employ or hire approximately 200 people a year. We rehire about 50 staff a year. Again, many college, high school students, they're off going to college. They come back for the summer. They leave in the fall to go back to school, or they've got the sports season. We certainly work with them to be flexible enough that when they need time off for prom, finals, whatever activities are going on in their lives, that is our goal, to be a flexible employer, and that's part of what we do. So those are our three concerns with this bill, and I thank you very much for your time today. Thank you
very much. Mr. Espenson, the Chamber's got a point of view, eh?
We do, believe it or not, Mr. Chair. Jeremy Espenson with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll keep my comments as brief as I can. I'm here today in opposition to House File 612. Minnesota employers are doing everything they can to keep people at work right now, and in many cases can't bear any extra mandated costs from government. Employees understand the value of and do a great deal to promote a healthy workforce already. The Minnesota Chamber supports allowing businesses to establish benefits packages that are sustainable and best fit their unique needs. This bill would not only create additional costs for employers, but administrative and legal burdens as well. Now, there's a document that looks like this on your desk, I believe. I'm just going to walk through a couple of key points and try to make this relatively quick. One of the things, let me back up and say, we surveyed our entire membership.
We asked HR contacts at each of our member businesses to get back to us with what they thought this would do to their business. And we got 300 and some responses back. Pages 2 and 3 go through some of them that granted us permission to use their stories. But one of the things that most folks said is if we have an existing structure to offer vacation and sick leave, what's going to happen is that we're going to just transition some of the existing vacation into sick leave. So it'll eliminate some flexibility for those folks to be able to use their benefits in a way that best suits their needs. Another really major point, and this is the fourth from the bottom, is the carryover cost. And when these folks are going to be able to carry over the number of hours, whatever it is, businesses are going to have to write that on their books, and it's going to potentially prevent them from getting credit. It's going to add costs that may prevent them from running their businesses the way they've traditionally been able to do. And finally, one of the points that a member business asked me to make was he's a manufacturer in northern Minnesota, and he's got some full-time employees and some part-time employees. His part-time employees don't receive any benefits, as full-time employees do. But the point he asked me to make is that his part-time employees are college kids, high school kids, and some retired folks. They choose to come and work in this part-time situation because it gives them the flexible schedule that allows them to do whatever else it is that they do, go to college, go to high school, play golf, whatever it is, but they choose to do those things. And finally, Mr. Chair, as I mentioned, the back two pages list just some of the hundreds of responses we got from chamber membership about this bill. Their thoughtful comments come directly from HR staff or company owners. Most responses highlight the cost and loss of flexibility their employers would face with mandatory sick leave programs. This bill at best could reduce existing flexible benefits for employees and create new costs to businesses at a time when they cannot afford them. At worst, this bill could lead to layoffs and businesses closing their doors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Estenson. Ms. Poole, before you go, we have Buzz Anderson, Rob Reinert, Mike Hickey, and Joe Matthews. A lot of, what he said or what she said would work. Ms. Poole.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Jamie Poole. I'm the president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. We are a trade association representing the retail food industry. 1897, excuse me, we're playing bumper cars here. We have over 200 retail members supplying nearly 1,000 stores and approximately 100 distributors and manufacturers. Our member companies employ over 85,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. The food retail industry fully understands that employees need time off both for personal and family matters. Grocers are compassionate and sensitive, often going above and beyond the ordinary needs of their employees. Unfortunately, the Healthy Family, Healthy Workplace Act provides no flexibility for employers in designing leave programs for their associates. This act would be disruptive to store operations and staffing because it allows for a wide berth of unscheduled absences and potential for misuses. A rural third-generation grocer who is one of the largest employers in his community of 5,000 said if this were to become law, he would be forced to make cuts in other benefits he currently offers to provide the mandated paid sick leave. With his current benefits program, he has had the ability to assist several employees through a variety of paid leave, from rehabilitation to family illnesses. Another grocer tells us that this is paving the way to create a mandated system of abuse, adding stress in a time of tremendous economic challenge. With a cognizance to time, we respectfully oppose the Healthy Family, Healthy Workplace Act, which creates a rigid and highly disruptive mandate. We believe self-management is the key to creating a responsible program that is feasible to administer and protects the viability of our communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, I think you were on deck, and then Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Buzz Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association. I sent an email to Representative Lesh this morning apologizing to him for not having spoken to him personally about my opposition or opposition to this bill. So I'll say that publicly. I owed him that courtesy, and I was unable to do so. Retailers provide a very, very important benefit to Minnesotans. According to the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Security, we provide more jobs in this economy than any other sector. Here's the poster that we use and we send out to our members. And I'll pass this around, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. the regulations that we already have to comply with as large businesses and small businesses are overwhelming. Regulations are costly. More regulation means more cost to business, and it has unintended consequences. For example, because the sick leave is expanded, employers will expect to see more absenteeism. That's the cost to business. With more cost to business, that means less investments in expansion, less ability to provide benefits like health care, vision, dental, and other types of health care benefits that they're already struggling to give employees. And believe me, when I say they're struggling to do so, they are struggling to do so. As some others have pointed out, excuse me, some are going to have to seriously look at also cutting vacation back, which is offered to employees, if they're going to also accommodate the provisions of this bill. This bill opens up also additional significant legal costs to retailers. The bill allows employers to bring civil action, allows the Attorney General to bring civil action. It allows the Attorney General to impose a $1,000 fine. It allows for class action lawsuits. One of the unintended results of this is our insurance is going to go up, and it's already at the breaking point. The bill actually also provides an incentive to, not to hire people. Don't hire more than 10 employees if you absolutely have to, is what smaller employers will strive for. And other employees, particularly large ones, will move to technology because machines don't get sick, they don't hassle the boss, they don't take advantage of benefits. As a small town department store owner told me this morning, the piggy bank is just about empty. Ask legislators not to make it more difficult to be in business, or we're in fact going to have to go out of business. And this comes from a company that's been in business for over 100 years. Retailers are very proud of the number of jobs that we provide. House File 612 is a bill that is going to make it more costly to provide jobs, and we would ask you to oppose the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Matthews, I assume that the public sector's concerns are the public sector's concerns, and were discussed earlier, but please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Mr. Carlson from the Minnesota Intercounty Association already distributed some written comments. I just want to highlight four concerns that we've heard from our HR folks. One being that they see this as an interference with the collective bargaining agreements with their unions. Two, there's concerns from some counties that have a six-month probationary period for new hires, and the bill allows for a 90-day period where they could start using sick leave. Three would be the carry forward of sick leave. Counties, I think almost all counties have a cap, and for employees who might get the cap, we're confused as how that would interact. And then the last part is we have a number of employers that are going to paid time off or PTO, which is combined sick and vacation leave, and they're concerned that this would kind of move backwards, and that's been an agreement between labor and employment. So those are our four concerns from AMC, and you know, that's the policy side of things there.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 612? Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Representative Zellers. Representative Zellers, you may have been out of the room. We do have another committee coming in.
They obviously don't have the purview as this chairman in the committee room.
Oh, it's Hilty.
Seniority. I'll be quick.
All right,
chairman.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh, the question that came up towards the end is exactly my concern, because quite honestly, I think as progressive as you are and as new wave as you are, you're actually taking us backward in time. Prior to having small children, when I'd have sick days built up, a pretty healthy guy, I'd have to either do the I'm sick today and not go in, or I would lose the days. Two of the companies that I work for, I talked to a number of employers, said going to the PTO or pay time off was far better for all employees because then they could choose. I'm just curious as to why you'd want to upset something that's a new, something that's helping all employees versus, you know, going back to an old system.
Representative Rush.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zellers, first off, if those for those employers that, mm-hmm. that offer PTO, they're covered under this bill. If you can go in and say I'm sick and it counts toward paid time off, it counts toward this. We didn't make it a paid time off bill because it's aimed toward healthy families and it's related to health, so it's sick time, not vacation time or other personal time. But if you do that already, you're covered.
Well, here's
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Well, But if you go through all your PTO, then you don't have the employer doesn't have sick as defined sick leave. What then? So will the employer, what's the additional paid time off? Or I guess I don't understand. If you don't have sick leave, the bills, I understand that, maybe I'm wrong, you're requiring additional time off. So if you have PTO and you're going to require extra sick leave, I'm not sure how that's going to work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zeller, it's not additional. If the PTO can count toward that you're sick and you can't come in, if your PTO agreement allows for that, then and you have at least and you give at least one for every 30 hours work, and you're a small employer, and you give you cap out at the number we have capped out under this bill, which is 72 for a large employer, and 40 for a small employer, then you're covered. So you don't have to give anything additional.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. With that, members, Representative Nelson, I believe you moved to House File 612 to be before the committee.
Mr. Chair, can I have some time to explain a couple items before we wrap up? Or we
briefly, please, Representative Lash, 30 seconds or less, please.
Just two things, a couple things, Mr. Chair. We've heard many of these same arguments with respect to the Family and Medical Leave Act when that came up, that businesses were going to go under. We see that clearly didn't happen. Also, some of the arguments you heard, in particular, I took some notes regarding the testifier from the city of Shoreview. Some homework needs to be done on this numbers, because these numbers were way off. Calculating a cost of $2,700 in a two-week period based on the total hours worked does not compute for this bill. It's per individual employee. You cannot take the total hours worked for all your employees, divide by 30, and then come up with the total number of sick days that you'd have to give off. That's not what the bill does. Someone needs to do their homework on this. Second, remember that it's 56 hours. You have to you work 90 days, and you have to work 56 hours in order to do it. So you still wouldn't cap out of the time regarding the cost. Also, as was stated within an answer to Representative Zeller's question, you can use it in the existing structure. With respect to collective bargaining units, lastly, this is simply made a void provision in any contract. So you can easily collectively bargain, but if you collectively bargain for provisions that are less than what is allotted for employees, then it's a void portion of that contract individually. So it does not interfere with collective bargaining.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 612 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you to everyone.